Hi, I'm Desi Arnaz Jr. Welcome to Letting Go with Guy Finley. Guy is the best-selling author of Let Go and Live in the Now, and is the founding director of nonprofit Life of Learning Foundation. And now, here's Guy Finley.
There's a great and beautiful classic song called Over the Rainbow. Almost everyone has heard it. Somewhere Over the Rainbow. Now, the first thing that we're going to look at is why is the song called Somewhere Over the Rainbow instead of Somewhere at the End of a Rainbow? Because the way we look at things, the end of the rainbow is where the gold pot is. Isn't that how it goes? You know, the wee leprechauns put the gold there at the bottom of the rainbow so that human beings could have lots of money and be miserable. Why over the rainbow? And not the end of the rainbow. The answer should be pretty evident to us. But if it's not, I'll just take a minute to explain the difference. Over the rainbow refers to something that isn't physical. A place where happy little bluebirds fly. Meaning a place that doesn't have this on-again, off-again happiness. A place where a person, if they can find that world over the rainbow, which of course refers to heaven, no matter who you are, even if you're a wee little one. And the question that has to be asked for a person who's sincere in their interior wish to find a life that doesn't have these horrible, consistent states of discouragement and discontentment, offset, yes, true enough, by moments in which it looks as though one has found the end of the rainbow. But truth be told, the gold that we find at the end of the rainbow is subject to the world that put it there. And when we don't want to be subject anymore to the way and the whims of the way the world turns, we can begin to do something that we're going to talk about this morning. We're going to talk about, actually the talk of the title, talk is use these, I don't know what the name of the title is. Use this pair of spiritual wings to lift you over the rainbow. Use this pair of spiritual wings to lift you over the rainbow. I want you to understand that there actually does exist a place over the rainbow. That's the first thing I want you to understand. And I know that a lot of you are discouraged. I know that discontentment and despair are the wings that we're used to flying with because we try to reach the sun as did Icarus and all of that business, and we soon find ourselves plummeting back to the earth that we tried to rise from. But there really does exist a place over the rainbow. And human beings know it to a small degree because everyone has tasted that a little bit. Some of us just taste it when we happen to go out and actually see a rainbow. And for a moment, all of that doubt and worry, everything's suspended because we're filled for our relationship in the moment with that rainbow. We're filled with something that's beyond our ability to think about. Same when we see anything that's awesome in nature, or we see an act of love that defies our ability to consider it. In such moments, we are transported in a way over the rainbow. We're transported past what our mind is able to give us from its contents. From its wings, if you will. So we immediately set out and we create a difference here to understand what we're talking about. That there is the wings that we have given ourselves that have always melted under severe conditions. Or sometimes, if you notice, it doesn't need any condition at all. You can get up and go, I'm going to fly today, and there's nothing on your shoulders. You're earthbound. So the spiritual wings that we need, we have to understand. And I was thinking this morning, just before the talk, how many of you heard the expression, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink? How many of you think that was some wise cowboy that made that? Actually, it wasn't. Its origin is from the East. It has a Sufi origin. And it had to do with a camel, not so much a horse. But the meaning of it is that you can lead the flesh to the truth, but you can't make the flesh take the truth into it. Horse, camel being the animal nature, this lower nature. And water being what has always been water throughout time is this spiritual understanding. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. That's why when we go to understand this idea of the spiritual wings, a pair of spiritual wings that can lift us over the rainbow, that pair of spiritual wings that we're going to identify is this: true knowledge, right action. There's your spiritual wings. True knowledge, right action. Without true knowledge, we're left with the knowledge that we presently call upon in moments of discontentment and despair. And always the knowledge that we call upon when things get rough is that knowledge which has to do with what's at the end of the rainbow. Because for us, when things are rough, it's because we haven't or we've lost the end. We had something in mind that we wanted to be. We saw something we were going to do and become. And little by little by little, maybe we approximate it. Maybe we even get there. How many of you have actually made it to the end of the rainbow? All of us have in one way or another. Did you ever get your dog to sit? I mean, a small victory, but for a moment, you're the king. You're the alpha male or the alpha female in the pack. Dog sat. I'm someone. Bigger scale things? Sure. I achieved my goal. I made my sales quota. You fill in the blank for yourself, but you no more get to the end of the rainbow than you walk into the office the next day and someone says there's another rainbow. That rainbow, that was yesterday's rainbow, man. Got to go on to the next rainbow. And I want you to understand that the true rainbow over which we are intended to fly doesn't have a next. That rainbow that represents a certain distinction between our present nature and our possibility as a human being to become spiritual, truly spiritual, not intellectually spiritual, not religiously spiritual, not any of those ridiculous things that people say are their wings and that always cause them to fly into one another instead of over the rainbow. So, true knowledge followed by right action. Without true knowledge, nothing can happen, as I said. Why? Because we're always left to the best that we have understood. And then part of this right action is born out of realizing that in certain moments, I'll ask you, how many have ever come to the point where you knew for yourself that you were about to do something you'd done 100 times before, but maybe this time it would be different for you? Raise your hands. This is pretty much what human beings do. Now, is that right action? Or is that called stupid hope? It's called stupid hope. Anything that a person hopes, well, that's the definition of insanity, I heard. Thinking that you can do the same thing and have a different result. So right action, true knowledge. Now, true knowledge requires honesty, which is why so few people have true knowledge. Because, and this is so critical, so take a deep breath, I'll invite you to do it a number of times. True knowledge is not what you hear someone say. You read a book, true knowledge. No, that's not true knowledge. True knowledge is what happens when an individual, through his or her willingness to see the truth of something, sees what is so in such a way that they themselves become integrated into that which they have seen. That is true knowledge. We could call it wisdom. Because in such a moment, the person never again has to think to himself, what do I do in such instances? Because their spirit, their soul has been seated with, merged with, that understanding about the moment. Not the understanding, listen. Not the understanding as we are now. How many of you understand this idea? Our understanding now is what we have to remember after the moment passes. A lot of good that is. What do you think you're stressed about? We're stressed because we're trying to remember so many ways to respond to moments that are appropriate to our image that the moment passes by, we come up with who we were supposed to be, and then who we're supposed to be is inappropriate to the next moment. Have you ever had that happen to you? Like you're at a party with people and something happens and you know you have something funny to say and you're trying to remember who you're supposed to be, and then you finally come out with it, but the conversation's moved on, and then you're like a double idiot. Then you have to come up with the appropriate response to that. So this knowledge that we're talking about, that's what we're going to look at. We're going to see how that's possible for us to gain it. And then follow me. Because once we have that true knowledge, right action is the other wing of it. Because when we understand what doesn't work, what isn't true, what will not deliver us, when we understand the difference between over the rainbow, meaning above and beyond the capacity of things seen, you know that passage, our hope must not be in things seen, but in things unseen. When we can understand that, then we cannot be tempted into action that betrays our own integrity. What a thought! I don't think you're thinking it like me. What a thought! I can't be betrayed. What a thought. Something exists by which, when I understand it, makes what I am in that moment impervious to the possibility of betraying myself by being tempted into an action against myself. What a thought. What safety. And that's what we're after. So let's get started. Take a deep breath because we have so much to go through. So much to go through. We have to start with knowledge. Ready for some knowledge? And I could start way back. I don't think I will, but I always love this thought because it's fun. You know, it is said that man is what basically conditioned and developed the existence of the dog. That, you know, man's relationship with early wolves and all the rest of that gradually conditioned the wolf to become the dog that we have today. You've all heard that, haven't you? Well, it's not true. It was the wolf that conditioned men. That's the truth. Because gradually what happened is they bonded, formed this relationship, first starting with simple things like food. Then human beings began to become dependent upon the animal to protect it, so it didn't have to think anymore that I have to sit and watch out over this fire because now I've got something around me that's going to get up and bark if something comes. So little by little by little, our sense of security was not that we didn't make the animal into what it is. The animal allowed us to become what we are in some respects. Can you understand that idea? It's the same thing with light and our eyes. Light actually developed our eye, not our eye developed light. They've discovered this. Science now looks back and is able, through its process of deduction, to analyze and see that the eye over the course of time has gradually become far more receptive to variant degrees of higher forms of light, higher and lower forms of light, that it wasn't in our earlier days when we were being conditioned by the wolf. Oh boy. Human beings sure have painted a different picture of themselves, haven't they? You know, we conquered this, we conquered that. The wreck of the human race. Light actually helped form the eye. And it's an important distinction, this knowledge, because what it means is that the higher is always working on the lower. The subtler is always working on the less subtle. That what is spiritual works on physical. That what is refined works on what is less refined. It can't be the other way around. It's not like that when it comes to the development of things. Now, the reason I'm making this point is for the true knowledge that we're looking for, which is this. Thought has conditioned the mind. Thought, our thoughts have actually formed our brain and the way it works. Thought has actually helped condition and form the brain that thinks. Now, how specifically? Because we must get to a certain point so we can move on. Thought has conditioned the brain, now listen, to see what validates itself. Thought has conditioned the mind to see what validates those thoughts. A divided mind is always working in a set of unseen opposites. And thought creates an image. And then the image is substantiated by the content that actually was responsible for generating that image. Now, don't get lost in that idea. We're not going to be psychologically deep, too deep this morning. I want you just to understand, well, how many of you can see what I'm saying? That when you look out and you see someone who has done something to you, do you not know all the reasons why that person is wrong and why they shouldn't have done it? So that everything that we see with our mind through thought gives us, as we're seeing it, that which validates what is seen. And it's a collusion. It's a conspiracy of a sort, but it isn't detected by the mind that's filled with that kind of thought, because the mind never suspects that what it is seeing and validating is part of something, now listen, that keeps it under the rainbow. That keeps it living in a world in which there can be no possibility of spiritual wings, because everything the mind creates validates the past, validates what was, validates everything that has to do with who I have been. And if who I have been can get over the rainbow, why am I here? So now we'll take this knowledge. And we're going to examine something. I'm going to ask you a question. If you're listening to this at home or on the radio or wherever it is, I want you to answer the question as honestly as you can. The tendency that we have towards discontentment, is it greater or less than our tendency to feel content and grateful to life? Which is it? Huh? Yeah. I didn't hear what anybody said. I just heard a flood of voices. Our tendency towards discontentment far outweighs our tendency towards contentment. Yes?
Yes.
Yes. Now, that in itself is a bizarre thing, really. Especially where we live. I don't know if you've ever traveled to any other parts of the world. But boy, do we have it easy here. But what is it that's going on when, day in and day out, and I urge you to be honest. Remember I said that honesty is part of the knowledge we're after? You examine your life in this moment. And you look and see whether or not on a moment-to-moment basis, 24 hours a day for as many years as we've been on this planet, although when we were children it wasn't quite this way, whether or not your tendency is to want what life is bringing to you or to not want it. And the answer is, by and large, at least half the time, we don't want what's happened. We wish it wasn't the way it was. We want things to be different, which is the same as not wanting. I better put this in, because some of you say, I'm not like that. If you wish things were different, it's the same as wishing they weren't what they are. And most of us, our lives are spent exactly like that, not with a tendency towards gratitude and contentment, but a tendency towards pushing away and feeling discouragement and discontentment towards our life in the moment. Now, what on earth is going on? Why is it? And here's, see, this is part of the problem. Now we got to jump back. Do you understand that most of us have good reasons why it's like that? And if you could just see that for a minute, you could see what's going on. I have lots of reasons why I'm a miserable man. Oh, that's good. What hope is there in a mind that can validate it being a victim? When everything it searches for, that it substantiates itself by, is part of the basis in the moment by which it feels this discontentment. In other words, it's a cycle and a downward cycle. Discontentment, discouragement are not the wings that take a person over the rainbow, because that mind can imagine in its unhappiness a new happiness to come. Because such a mind can only imagine from the content of itself, which is not over the rainbow, but part of what is making him feel like he's always in a storm. So what's this nature? What's going on that the tendency we have is towards this expression of being discontented all the time? And here's the answer. So take a deep breath, because we're going to explain it all. You won't hear anything that you won't be able to see while I'm talking. This expression of discontentment, this tendency we have towards discouragement, is born out of the unseen effect of a comparative mind. It is born out of the negative effect of a comparative mind. Now don't throw it away just because you heard some words, comparative mind. What does that mean? By the way, all negative reactions are the instantaneous expression of a comparative mind. Why? I don't understand it. As opposed to, I understand all things. Our tendency towards discouragement and discontentment is born out of a mind that is comparative in its root. Remember, we talked about how thought itself has helped make the brain the way it is. Now, let's examine what the idea of a comparative mind is. Here's a comparative mind. At the simplest level, you go to a restaurant. I'll ask you, how many of you have gone to a restaurant and your eggs didn't come out right and you got negative? Raise your hands. They buttered your toast on the wrong side. I'll give you a minute to think about that. Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have preferences in life relative to how our eggs are prepared or that our toast is buttered on the right side, O ye of Lilliput. But I'm saying that that kind of preference is the root of pain. And when we can see that the root of pain is a mind that examines the moment and compares what has taken place in it to what it wished had taken place or what it preferred, that such a mind is in a constant state of discontentment because it is forever weighing what is against what ought to be. That's a comparative mind. I look at myself. How many of you look at yourself and feel immediately discouraged? On a given day, you know it's true. I didn't make the $1 million by the time I was 98. As you get older, you move the age up. You give somebody money to buy lottery tickets leave it in your will. Buy me lottery tickets so at least I can make $1 million, even if I'm not here. Who I am, I'm discontent with. And it's common to us. It's common to us to feel discouraged and discontent with ourselves as though it makes sense to be negative over who we are because somehow it proves to us that we're more than that. No, you're not more than the discontentment when you're feeling it. If you want to be more than the discontentment, give it up. But we'll get to that. So this comparative mind is the root of this discontentment and this discouragement. How would you say, should we say, this comparative mind is our earthly feet, not spiritual wings. Shall we say that? This comparative mind thinks to itself, look at me, man, I'm going up, I'm taking off today. And then it gets up to a certain distance, and because what it is seeking is nothing other than the content of an opposite, it's in itself, bang, it crashes down. So, now we have to do a little more deep digging. So take another breath. But I want you to see this. If a mind was just a comparative mind, that would mean it was balanced. Look, how many of you get negative when you compare an apple and an orange? You can't get negative comparing apples and oranges unless you happen to own an orange grove. Then you're an orange person instead of an apple person. So the simple comparison of two things has no inherent discontentment in it, does it? For instance, again, here's a better way to put it. You go to somebody's house, and God help you if this happens to you, and it does, and they say, I'm painting the living room. Which color do you like better? There are three things you should never discuss. Politics, religion, and decorating. Because essentially you can't win in any one of them. Because why? Because basically, incidentally, at their root, they're all born out of this comparative mind seeking a contentment that it finds through the approval and the acceptance of others. If you go against what that comparative mind is doing at that moment, you're its enemy, which we'll get to. But I'm looking, I'm at somebody's house, and frankly, I don't care whether it's blue or periwinkle. Just to pick two colors off the top of my head. Make yourself happy. Blue, periwinkle, well, that's great. And I know, my wife would tell me, men don't understand. And perhaps they don't. Which is okay too. Isn't it? I mean, where's the problem then? Paint the thing. We're having way too much fun to talk about something too serious. But the fact is, I'm not in pain over this. I have no pain. Periwinkle, maybe pain, but blue, not that bad. So the root here is that in a simply comparative process, there is no need for discouragement and discontentment. So now I ask you, when we get serious again, why is it that in our comparative mind, everything that it does produces that unwanted, discouraged, discontented state? That's the question. Do you see what we're doing with knowledge? We're looking to see how things are in a natural state. A natural process of comparison simply weighs things. There is a process of decision and there's not a negativity in it. But when that comparative mind is weighing who I ought to have been against who I am, what you should have done versus what you did, what the weather is today versus what I was hoping it would be, that in that process of comparison, there's a consistent state of conflict that obviously is producing this state inside of ourselves by which out of is born discouragement, discontentment, not wanting it, pure resistance. Yes or no? All right. Now, what is that? Follow me? We're divorcing ourselves from our own mind for a moment, which we must do. We'll never come to true knowledge as long as we let our own mind analyze itself. We have to be willing to see, not think. We're seeing right now. We're seeing that a naturally comparative mind isn't conflicted. It's part of the proper process of practical thought. But we are abandoned by that natural state of practical thought and become punished by the way our mind works in its comparative action. What's at the root of that? Because you see, if we can find that out, if we can do a little bit of digging here and see for ourselves, well, what's happened here? Then maybe we'll have an insight into what it is that produces on a far greater basis than not why people walk around discouraged and discontented, negative. I'll just say it frankly, ugly, ugly, ugly human beings. A human being is conditioned to accept ugliness.
You're listening to Letting Go with Guy Finley. For more information about Guy's life-empowering ideas, visit GuyFinley.com. We'll be back in a moment.
Love, the brightest and most powerful force in the universe. Love melts stress and cancels resentment. It gives birth to kindness and is the fuel of success. Love is at the heart of every great relationship and is the true essence of lasting peace. In his new book, Apprentice of the Heart, best-selling author Guy Finley explores lessons in life only love can teach. This breakthrough book contains the tools you need to strengthen and deepen all of your relationships with family, friends, coworkers, and with the present moment itself. Apprentice of the Heart, available now at GuyFinley.com and fine bookstores everywhere. Joseph Polansky of Diamond Fire magazine writes, "The reader is lifted up to a whole new realm, a rarefied region of the soul." To order your copy of Guy Finley's Apprentice of the Heart, visit GuyFinley.com. That's GuyFinley.com. The relationship your heart longs for already exists.
Welcome back to Letting Go with best-selling author Guy Finley.
Because when we are negative, we are ugliness itself. Ugliness has been incorporated into our body. We have actually embodied ugliness. Call it evil if you wish. That which cannot be reconciled by itself. That which cannot be reconciled by itself. What does that mean? A negative state finds justification for itself. It looks for resolution through what has created it. Therefore, a negative state can never resolve or reconcile itself. All it does is prove to itself its right to exist. We must see that negative states have no right to exist in us, or we'll never make it over the rainbow. Because there's no negative states over the rainbow. No ugly states. So what's at the root of this then? Why is there discontentment, and what's the nature of this dissatisfaction that I feel when I look at my life if simple comparison doesn't have that conflict in it? And it's pretty simple, in case we've already touched on it. I'm identified. I have an idea about how things are supposed to be. My view is that you are intended to throw palm fronds in front of me when I walk. Your view is that I'm supposed to pay you to throw those pay. In other words, all day long, whether we see it or not, there is something, and we'll call it personal, at work in our mind that is producing this resistance to the way life is unfolding. Simply resisting it because life is not expressing the ideal that we're identified with. How many of you call yourself stupid? Raise your hand. Now, I've said this a number of different ways, but I want to go back over one more time. When you're stupid, who's smart? Well, it must be you. Because you're stupid. And you're talking to yourself, which, by the way, is pure psychosis. Stupid. Thank God I'm smart enough to know that you're stupid. Isn't that it? Thank God I am wise enough to know what a really big idiot you are. And if I was in charge of things, we wouldn't do stupid things. See, that's a lie. That's a divided mind. A mind that identifies with the ideal of itself as being wiser than what it just did that wrecked everything. And that mind clings to the image of what it ought to be, of what it is, what it should be. And when it compares itself to the image, which clearly, do you understand it? See, this is the problem. You think to yourself, no, it's true. I am wiser than my stupidity. Well, where was your wisdom in the moment? It wasn't there. You know what? It'd be like a man jumps out of the plane. He forgets his parachute. He gets to the bottom. He survives the fall. They say, well, why did you do that? Well, I thought I had it. What do you mean you thought you had it? Well, I remembered it was there after I jumped. I remembered that I shouldn't have hurt you after I hurt you. Then I hate myself for the hurt that I exacted. I remember that I shouldn't be someone impatient after I've been impatient. Then I hate myself for my impatience. This is a comparative mind, a divided mind, that believes that the image it has of itself, now listen carefully, that image is the same as actually being ourself, because when the moment comes that reveals it's not, I resist the moment. I push the moment away and say, no, that can't be, because I'm looking at what I say should be. Now, this is an important transition, so take a deep breath. We're about halfway through the talk. That means at that moment, what we are doing is that our mind is engaged in an activity that sees, now listen, that sees at first only what is unwanted. I see a me I don't want to be. Now, can I see a me that I don't want to be without having in that mind the image of the me that I ought to be? I can't. So the me that I ought not be is itself an opposite of the me that I'm sure I could be. Yes? Now, what am I seeing then in the moment? This is pivotal. What am I seeing in the moment of my discontentment? What I'm seeing in the moment of my discontentment, of feeling discouraged, is that my mind's eye, and remember those two words, my mind's eye in those moments is on something that my mind has fabricated. It has fabricated the image of myself as being someone who isn't up to par. Please, I know you say, no, I'm like this is this. My, I know I am not up to par. Clearly. What does that have to do with discouragement and discontentment? What does the fact of myself have to do with the condemnation of myself? Because can't you see, if one condemns oneself, then one is condemning oneself to live in the cycle of discouragement and discontentment that is born out of resisting an image of himself. Which means that in that moment, and this is everything been leading to this, my mind is seeing that which it has imagined, and having imagined it, it doesn't want it. First, I imagine what I'm not, based on this opposite of what I believe I ought to be. I imagine myself. Have you ever thought yourself to be just about the worst human being that ever walked the planet? Raise your hands. I actually hope that you have, because in a way, it's true. But not personal. Something lives inside of us that has compromised and betrayed us in ways in which it's impossible to consider with the mind. That's why we're working at new knowledge that's going to lead us to the new action. This pair of wings that will lift us over the rainbow. The mind produces an image. The image that it produces of how things are. That they're not right. That I'm not making it. That I never will. The mind produces that image. How many of you can see that it produces that image? Then it resists the image that it makes. First it creates a picture that is an opposite of what we discussed. Then it's, I hate this. How many of you make for yourself, I'll speak personally, I don't particularly like cilantro. So I don't make myself a cilantro quiche. No. I don't make cilantro juice for myself. Because I can't imagine it. Now, would you be surprised to go out into the kitchen and find yourself making something that you can't stand? My wife walks in, why are you making that face? I'm drinking cilantro juice. Why did you make cilantro juice? I don't remember making it. The mind fabricates an idea, a picture, an image of something that as soon as it makes the picture, it doesn't want it. It refuses it. No, that can't be. Look, how many of you think you know what's going to happen tomorrow? Unfortunately, you do. That's part of the divided mind. Mind comes, look, something happens. You start to think about tomorrow. Oh, God. And by the way, isn't most of our discontentment and discouragement born out of that which we think is a coming to us? That's what we think. That which we think is coming to us. Now, that which we're not going to become, not going to make. Well, who made that picture? The mind. And the mind that makes the picture then hates the picture it makes. And there is the root of this discontentment. in the activity of the mind that goes on unseen. But now we talk about the action. Now we talk about the solution to this, because even though I'm giving it to you by simply showing you how it works, we can do something different. Take a story. I'm going to take a deep breath. Take a deep breath. I have a story. Help us understand how it's possible to begin to change this relationship, so that instead of these earthen wings that melt, that can't lift us, we can begin to do and find within ourselves that which already lives over the rainbow. Here's a pair of traveling salesmen. They've been working together for the same company for 25 years. Did anybody ever see The Big Kahuna? It's a great film with Danny DeVito and a few others. Anyway, these men traveling together, and they move into a city, as they often do in their travels, and they take a hotel room because they're going to be there for 10 days or 2 weeks doing various conventions for their sales purposes. And both of them are pretty up and bright and happy fellows, and we'll call them Bill and Will. And Will and Bill check into this hotel, and I don't know, if any of you travel, you know, most hotels are situated in such a way that one side of them looks out onto a nice park, the open city, and the other side looks out onto a dump, basically. And they usually put you, if you're not VIP or didn't request otherwise, they usually put you on the side of the way. Okay, so you got the point. Will and Bill check in, and they're both pretty upbeat for the first couple days, but little by little by little, Will starts to notice that Bill is looking ill. He offers him a pill, but Bill says, "No, Will." I have fun even if you don't. And he notices that Bill's spirit is sinking and sinking and sinking. And he says, "Bill, what's wrong?" "I don't know. I seem to be losing my love, my feeling about all this. I just don't feel right." And finally, Will is concerned about Bill, and so he comes to his room to talk to him, see if he can't give him a little peppy, you know, motivational talk, get him back on track so they can make their sales quota, which is enough to depress you. And he walks into Bill's room, and he sits down. First he's sitting down, and he's talking to Bill. Bill's sitting on the bed, Will's sitting on the chair, looking up towards the front door of the room. And he gets up to get a glass of water, and he's walking back, and he looks, and there's Bill's window. And Bill's window is looking out at an old smokestack and dilapidated buildings, tenements, basically. Just a horror of a picture out there. And he says to Bill, he says, "You know what, I think I know what will make you feel better." And Bill said, "What?" He said, "Well, I'm not going to tell you, because I want you to learn the lesson for yourself. I want you to have the knowledge from yourself. Because if I just tell you, you won't believe me and it won't be as effective." So he said, "I want you to do me a favor, Bill." "What, Will?" "I'm going to just request that you get a room nearer to mine, so we can talk a little bit more." "Well, it's not." "Nah, just do me a favor." So that's what Will does, is he gets Bill a room next to him. But he gets Bill a room with a different view. And sure enough, within 2 days, Bill is starting to perk up. And on the end of the third day, Bill's back to Bill. And Bill says to Will, "Why was I ill?" And Will says, "Come with me and look past the windowsill, Bill." Still, the story goes on. They go back, and now Bill looks out, and here's the point. Now he can see. Listen, now he can see what he couldn't see before. Is there someone at the door? Who is beeping? Something beeped. Never mind. Bill can see what he couldn't see before. And then he sees that it was the view he had. It was what he was looking at that he didn't know he was looking at that was making him feel the discontentment and discouragement that he was feeling. He couldn't know that before. Now I'm saying the same thing to you. I'm saying that day in and day out, all of us are looking at what we don't know we're looking at. Our attention, moment to moment to moment, is given to that which our mind gives our attention to without our awareness of the effect of what that attention is attending to. Which is why when the mind attends to an image of what it doesn't want, the mind never thinks to itself there's something amiss. When you're discouraged and discontented in life, there's never the smallest thought in your mind at that moment that there isn't a valid reason for why I feel the way I do. Because it is looking at and being justified in the same motion with the thoughts that it is attending to. So now what we're going to do for the rest of this talk We're going to look and see for ourselves that what we are given to see in any given moment is not the only view. That's as simple as it can be said. How about this? It is not required viewing to look at that which makes you feel discontent. It is not required viewing to feel you're a victim because of the thoughts that you're entertaining that tell you you are. It is not required that you look at anything that causes you to feel low. But we don't know what we're looking at. Whenever you are negative, your mind is showing you what it wants you to see so that it can generate the sensations that it is comfortable and familiar with in order to perpetuate that nature of that mind. That's what's going on. No matter how sure you are, I don't care what somebody did to you 50,000 years ago, and I don't care what may happen tomorrow that someone just said is inevitable. There is no substantial true, capital T, reason for any human being to ever identify with a negative state, period. And that's what we're going to look at. I have some points that we're going to go over. Because one would say, well, if I don't look at this, whatever this may be, if I don't look at this, then what should I be looking at? Do you understand the point? Because a man says, well, I just got the news that I'm getting fired. She says, I just got the news that he's leaving me. You should celebrate. I just looked in the mirror, which is always a good joke. Talk about discouragement. At that moment, what you don't want is due to what you are resisting. And what you are resisting is itself an opposite of an ideal that you're not conscious of, so that we wind up looking at and then wishing that what we were seeing as truth weren't so. Now we're going to prove that it isn't the truth. We're going to prove it. And here's the proof. First, I'll start with this. Whose eyes are those in your head? Whose eyes? They belong to your body, don't they? But there's this other thing in your body that can actually make your eyes look right or left. You can look at what you want to look at physically. Can anybody... Look, somebody says, no, you must look at this. Look. And they put it right in front of your face. What can you do? Close your eyes. I don't have to look at that. You can't make me look at anything I don't want to look at. Physically. Isn't that true? Someone's at the door again. I now know the problem. That's the person leaving. I don't care what the moment brings. You can always choose to use your attention to look at something else. And that's what we're going to do. Here are five things that you can choose to see in the moment where your own suffering, unwanted life, is telling you all there is to look at is what I'm showing you that justifies me. Got it? Here they are. Number one. First, I hope you'll understand this. First, you can see that the effect of your discouragement, the effect of your discontentment, is having a negative effect on another person. Whoever thinks to themselves, my discouraged, negative, taut, ugly face is harming another human being. You never do that. You know why you never do that? Because you never see anything except for the justification for your self-pity. Period. I don't see what my state is doing to other people. I don't have time. Because my state, number one, is consuming me, and as it's consuming me, it's telling me what I have to do to get a pair of wings to get away from you that's making me feel the way I do. So that's something else I could see. Yes or no? Could I use my attention instead of simply seeing what I don't want, what's discouraging me, can I use my attention to see what my effect is on other people being like that? Can I use that? Yes or no? Well, isn't that already something different to look at? And by the way, if you were ever able to see what you are like in the moment that you're with other people and see that you are pretty much bringing everybody down, because you're wallowing in the mud of some kind of self-reference thought or feeling about yourself, some ambition that didn't come to pass, whatever it is, then you would immediately begin to have compassion for the people around you, which would, if nothing else, would give you something else to think about. Number two, this is something else that we can see instead of seeing what our mind shows us. I can see the effect of this negative state on myself. Look, maybe that's not clear. When you're absorbed in a negative state and identified with why life isn't right, you're not seeing the effect that negativity is having on you. You're identified so thoroughly that you're justifying what that negative state is doing to you. Negative states, unattended to by the light of understanding, by that which reconciles them, kill us. I better bring this in for a minute. Anybody watch the Discovery Channels? Have you noticed that everything's eating everything? I mean, everything. I mean, wherever you go, something's eating something. Human beings, supposedly the top of the food chain. I have some good news for you and some bad news for you. We are not at the top of the food chain. Physically, we may be at the top of the food chain because our brain enables us to outmaneuver those things that would prey on us. But spiritually, we are not near the top of the food chain. And when you are negative, there is a force that is eating the force that's being generated in you. You are being consumed when you are negative. It's a fact. Just because we don't see forces consuming forces doesn't mean that there aren't forces consuming forces. And if it's a negative force that's dominant in you, I promise you there is something consuming it, and listen, and that needs that for its existence. Yes, such things exist, but that's another talk. So, number three of things in which we are able to choose what we want to look at instead of letting this mind in its unconscious, unattended state choose for us. We can see that any dark thoughts and feelings that denigrate anything or anyone are themselves that which is without value. I'm going to get it again. We can see that any dark thought or feeling that denigrates anything or anyone is itself that which is without value. See, this is a strange paradox that we don't see. Here's a person, and they're negative. They're negative about life. Now, if I'm negative about the value of life, doesn't that prove that I think I know what is valuable? Yes or no? Clearly. If I'm negative about the moment's value, it's because I have a higher set of values by which to live. How high are those values by which I choose to live if at the moment the whole of my being is being absorbed by and dictated to by a dark state? See, look, I'm trying to say this. I can see in the moment where I start to feel bad, discouraged, discontented, life's going nowhere. I can see that the only thing that's going nowhere is that negative state. Can I choose to see that? Do you understand? Can I put my attention on that? Because why? What happens when I put my attention on the truth of the moment instead of what the moment is telling me is true? What happens? Things change. In such a moment, I'm seeing the fact of the moment. And the fact of the moment gives me the action. And listen to this. This is so beautiful. And I don't have to act at all. I don't have to think to myself, what do? I know now what to do without thinking about it. I'm over the rainbow, really. Why? Because I just drop it. Who would participate with pulling himself apart? Do you think to yourself, today's a good day, I'm going to get up and I'm going to do everything I can to make myself as miserable as possible, and then I'm going to have a party afterwards? I mean, that sounds stupid, doesn't it? But if you examine your day and you look out and there's something wrong with this and that's not right and I didn't do this and this isn't going to take place the way I want it to, and I'm not changing, and all those things that your mind is ever talking to you about, you agree with those discontented states because by a strange form of an opposite, they prove to you that you're different than that. And I'm saying the only way we can be different than that is when we see that what is defining us has no right to. Number four. See that there is something in us, this darkness. Now listen. See that darkness, no matter what it calls itself, can never be more than half the story. Isn't that true? I mean, isn't the day divided up in darkness and light? Everything has those qualities in it. Where is the light that you see when you're dark? You see, you don't see light. Do you understand it? But there's a kind of a light by proxy, meaning that inside of oneself, by hating the darkness that I'm in, I believe that I'm the light. No, that which hates the darkness is darkness. That which despises what is wrong is part of the wrongness. When you see that this darkness, this wrongness is going on, it is by the action of light. Our task in the moment of this discontentment and discouragement is to see ourselves, is to see in such a moment the very fact that this darkness, how about this, that it can't be all there is. It can't be all there is. Isn't that giving your mind over to something that is true? Isn't that real knowledge? It is real knowledge. That's evident. But see, the knowledge, it's not present to me. Why? Because I can't see what I want to see in moments. Instead, I see what I'm shown. And this whole talk is about the process of a person starting to recognize, which is the next thing, you can always see that there's something higher. God, what kind of life would it be if all there was in the moment of discouragement, defeat, and despair was the darkness that called itself the light, that never could do anything but produce further processes of itself? If that's all there is, then we're done. But we're not done. Because there's an over the rainbow. Because the action that we've described begins to formulate itself in us when we understand the most simple and beautiful yet powerful spiritual truth there is. My attention is my own. My attention is mine. I don't have to give my attention to anything, let alone that which denigrates me or anyone else. I don't have to give my attention to that. But the mind, it's so used to that cycle of discouragement and despair, that defeat, it's so common to it that every instant produces a split second of reaction. Listen to this idea. The reason the world is in the state of decay is because thought is reactive. Thought only knows how to react. Boom, react. And what it reacts to is always the opposite. So we're going to do something different. We're going to start to understand this process. We can look at it very clearly. We can see this. You know, I'm feeling pretty low today. But I'm not going to let my mind, back to our story, I'm not going to look out that window. I'm not going to look out that window. I can use my attention to see something else. See, it isn't positive thinking. Try to understand this. First of all, how many of you get what we're going to? All right. Do you know that in the moment that you decide that you're going to look at what you want to, in other words, that what you're being shown is not required viewing, the moment that you decide to look at what you want to, what's going to happen to the nature that's been showing you what it's been showing you? It's going to enlarge the picture. Say, no, wait, man. You have to look at this. And you go, because you understand. No, I don't have to look at that. I'm going to look at something else. I'm going to look what the state is doing to me. I'm going to look at what the state is doing to others. I'm going to look to see that this thing, anything that denigrates, no matter how worthwhile it seems, can't be right. I'm going to look at anything but you. And in that moment, what has been making you look at what you've been looking at, it's going to get larger and larger until it will betray itself. It will. The darkness betrays itself at a certain point because it'll become ludicrous. You'll actually see a part of you trying to draw you in no matter what it has to tell you is true. It'll say, your nose is getting bigger. It'll tell you anything. I have a few minutes left to make the last point. Yesterday I was out and there were two young men. And as I was standing where I was standing, the commotion they made me turn my attention to them. And one of them had started wrestling with the other one. And the other one didn't want to particularly wrestle. I could see that. Let's say, you know how young, they weren't young. These guys were like 25. That's young to me. You know, young lions, young bears. And when I turned, the minute that my attention went to that, the one that didn't want to wrestle suddenly saw me see him. Now he wanted to wrestle. Because he didn't want to lose. So my attention to that moment actually changed the moment that I gave my attention to. It changed the behavior of those two people. Now, as an experiment, and I was conscious, I deliberately then withdrew my attention to see what would happen the minute I withdrew it. And the minute I withdrew my attention, the fight stopped. Because the other boy now had no reason to fight. Exact same thing with thought. We are drawn. Have you ever noticed how you're drawn to conflict? How you see people in a struggle, or you see an accident on the freeway. Our attention is drawn to that because it gives us in that attention something that establishes a relationship between ourselves and that conflict. We're separating ourselves from it. We're going to understand the tendency and then take that understanding, that new knowledge, and work with real action. And real action is always this gradual recognition that I need not give my attention to that which makes me ache. I can give my attention to that which is already over the rainbow. Do it, and you'll see yourself make it there.
Hello, I'm Desi Arnaz Jr. You've been listening to Letting Go with best-selling author Guy Finley. To learn more about Guy Finley and his nonprofit Life of Learning Foundation, visit GuyFinley.com, where you'll find a host of free, life-changing information. Thanks for joining us today.